Countdown. 10 seconds to firing.
9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Hello and welcome to the Martian Drive-In Podcast number 27. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around we're continuing the bug theme from the last podcast. I'm looking at a 1954 movie that we all know and love, Them, starring James Whitmore and James Arness. Then I'm zip-panning to 1997 for Guillermo del Toro's first English language film, Mimic, starring Mira Sorvino and Jeremy Northam. So it's insects all the way this time around, which is kind of apt because we are a little bit warm down this part of the world. So sit back, relax, and we'll get on with the show.
The Martian Drive-In Podcast is a fortnightly look at science fiction, fantasy, and horror films. New or old, it does not matter. What matters is that we like them and we find them interesting. Feedback is our soil and green, so you can email it to cultguru with a K at gmail.com. You can go over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook and drop a note. You can leave a message at marsdrivein.blogspot.com or put your dulcet tones into a voicemail at the new number, write it down, 206-337-5398. Occasionally there'll be adult concepts discussed, so this podcast can be explicit. And I would like to send a shout out to the NSA, GCHQ, and the Australian Signals Directorate. I hope you enjoy the shows, you mongrels.
Hello, how is everybody? It's going well here. To be honest with you, it is a little bit, in Spanish they call it muy caliente, in French they call it très chaud, and in English they call it this. Yep, it's a bit warm. It's going to be probably around 95 Fahrenheit or about 37 in centigrade today. And tomorrow is going to get up to 42, 43. So I thought I'd get the podcast done today, given the fact that it's a little bit cooler. And tomorrow I can just estivate on the couch and enjoy some movies or something like that. So things here have been going fine. As I said, it's summertime and the living is easy. I worked from home yesterday, which was kind of nice because at lunchtime I got to sit out in the sunshine with the cats. And the nice thing about sitting out in the sunshine when you're working from home rather than working at work is when you work from work and go out and sit in the sunshine, you're sharing the space with a whole bunch of smokers, which I don't have to do at home. But anyway, I hope everybody is doing fine. I know it's cold in certain areas, and I know that Russia's got the Olympics, even though their government is a bunch of homophobic fuckwits. And I'm ignoring all that because the Olympics, I never watch. I'm not into sports, really. It's not because I was bad at them at school. I did okay. I didn't like them particularly, but I did okay at them. It's just that I'm trying to avoid tribalism, and I don't like the way in sport, and I know a lot of people like it, but I don't like the way it's us versus them. I think that's a very kind of old way to do things, and I'm more inclusive these days, and I kind of like the fact that even though I'm doing a podcast and there are any number of other people doing podcasts, there's a weird kind of collaboration between people, and we encourage each other and nurture each other and listen to each other's podcasts. And I think that's my worldview is much more in line with that kind of an approach to things than to the sports way of doing things. So I'm going to ignore all of that stuff. I hope everybody comes home safe from it. And I hope that the people who are competing in the Olympics, who are going there mostly so that they can sleep with other people, have a nice time too, and I hope that people they sleep with have a nice time. But that's about as far as I'm going on that one. I'm back doing the radio gig too. I'm doing it with Liz Travascus on a Thursday night here in Australia. She's up at ABC Darwin, and she's taken over the gig from Ivor and is doing a very good job too. We've done two movies so far, and Liz and I are just kind of learning how each other work in that kind of environment. And so we did Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, the Shane Black written and directed movie starring Robert Downey Jr. and Fat Val Kilmer. And we had a lot of fun with that one. And just this week we did La Dolce Vita, the Federico Fellini movie. Now, La Dolce Vita is a bigger ask to talk about than Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. I really wanted to do it justice. I know a lot of people love the film. And it's such a complicated movie, and it runs almost 3 hours, as Liz said on the air. But I think we did okay talking about it, talking about the structure of it and having a good time with it. Even though this is a science fiction, fantasy and horror podcast, I recommend people see La Dolce Vita if you haven't, or if you haven't seen it for a long time, watch it again. As Liz also said on the air, based on Roger Ebert's review of the movie, the movie is one that your opinion of changes as you age. So as you become more mature, your opinion of the characters and of the movie itself evolves. So we had a bit of fun with that. Next time around, we're doing The Red Shoes. Liz asked to do a dance movie, so I thought I'd do Powell and Pressburger's The Red Shoes. And I'm looking forward to doing that too. Again, it's a challenging movie, but it's one that I think's worth getting out there and telling more people about. And I think we're going to have a lot of fun with that one. And then after that, I thought we might do, and this is just might, the forgotten James Bond film, Never Say Never Again, from 1983. But that's up to Liz, so we're still negotiating on that one. So that's what I've been up to in between podcasting and all of that other stuff. Now, I've changed from doing Mizzo to doing Letterboxd, which is Letterboxd without the E in the name of it. And so I've got a list of movies watched in 2014 up there that people can take a look at. If you go to letterboxd.com/paleocinema, one word, no dash, you'll be able to see all of the movies in graphic format that I've watched lately. So I'll take a look at a couple of the genre films I've watched since last we spoke. I saw a thing called The Body Stealers, also known as Thin Air. It's a British movie made by Tony Tenser in 1969, starring Sean Connery's brother Neil and a few other people. It's basically the whole conceit of it. George Sanders is in it not too long before he died. The whole conceit of it is a bunch of skydivers disappearing midair. And the English authorities have got to investigate this, of course, and there's an attractive alien woman who falls in love with one of the characters played by Patrick Allen, and it's a cheap and nasty little piece of work, but very typical of its time and very typical of the kind of genre films that were coming out of England in the 1960s. What else have I watched? I rewatched something interesting, the Luc Besson movie Lockout with Guy Pearce. It's basically Escape from New York in space. But having said that, it's a lot of fun. Guy Pearce is a lot of fun in it. And it's got some fantastic production values. They're quite good. And again, it's an entertainment and it's a little bit of an action flick. And not to be criticized too heavily for that, because you don't want to expect more than that from something where all of those, it's basically on the label. I looked at another giant insect movie, which I was going to do for the podcast, but I thought, no, it doesn't have enough to grunt, and it's not quite what I wanted. I looked at Eight-Legged Freaks, the movie from a few years ago, which is a little bit of fun, and is very much kind of in the, it's from 2002, it's very much in the style of the classic giant spider movies, a bit of fun. It's got David Arquette, Kerry Warra in it, and also in a supporting role, Scarlett Johansson. It's okay, but I really didn't have enough to grab onto from that film to have a bit of a chat about it, so I decided that I'd go with something else. So that's about it from the genre stuff I've been watching. I haven't really been hitting stuff heavily lately. With the hot weather, I've been out and about doing more things, which is always interesting too. I did a drive. Once a year, I get in the car and just drive for a day by myself. Sal was at home. and I drove 650 kilometres right up to the border with New South Wales and along the Murray River, the largest river in the country, up to Cahoona and Kerrang, two places which sound a little bit like Jack Kirby sound effects in a comic book. But I had a great day of it, just in there, in the car, chilling out, playing music loudly, and driving beautiful country roads. So that was, it's something I need to do about once or twice a year. Just get out there, get in the car by myself, get my head straight, stop, have breakfast somewhere, stop, have lunch somewhere, and come home. It's, yeah, there's something about it that's kind of primal and a little bit, I had thoughts of Tulane Blacktop and Vanishing Point and other movies like that while I was doing it. So that, it was quite fun and very, very enjoyable for me. So anyway, the two movies we're doing. We've got Them from 1954 and we have Mimic from 1997. Both of them trapped in the 20th century. Both of them taking different approaches to giant insects. And both of them very entertaining. So I'm going to take a break now. And when I get back, we're doing these chronologically. So I'll talk about Them from 1954, starring James Arness and James Whitmore, directed by Gordon Douglas.
I tell you, gentlemen, science has agreed that unless something is done and done quickly, man as the dominant species of life on Earth will be extinct within a year.
By direction of the President of the United States, stay in your homes, I repeat, stay in your homes. Your personal safety, the safety of the entire city, depends upon your full cooperation with the military authorities.
Yes, cities, nations, even civilization itself, threatened with annihilation, because in one moment of history-making violence, nature, mad, rampant, wrought its most awesome creation. For born in that swirling inferno of radioactive dust, were things so horrible, so terrifying, so hideous, there is no word to describe them.
We may be witnesses to a biblical prophecy come true, and there shall be destruction and darkness come upon creation, and the beast shall reign over the earth.
Yes, the earth, the skies above and the seas below, infested by swarms of nightmare creatures, crueler, deadlier than the armored giants of prehistoric eras. Here is a wild, headlong flight into terror as the desert erupts with the grim battle for survival. Here is a fear-frenzied moment of suspense as mankind totters before a thing that multiplies faster than it can be killed. Here is a desperate plunge into the black depths of the earth, where human courage challenges the brute force, the slashing jaws, the poison fangs that guard the subterranean nest where the beast spawns its terrible progeny.
To all units. To all units. Condition red. Drain 267 is the target area. Repeat. Condition red. Drain 267 is the target area.
Gas we could use?
No, we can't take a chance. It might poison the whole city.
There's something lovely about those bombastic trailers from the 1950s, particularly the ones for Universal monster movies like this one. Over the top, but very, very wonderful. I like this film a lot for a number of reasons, but the biggest one I can think of is James Whitmore playing Ben the cop. He's in there right from the start. He isn't there at the end. I'm not going to give it away, but he's not there at the end. And I think his plausibility as a New Mexico highway patrolman and as a real human character really carries this movie across a few bumpy bits. But I'm getting ahead of myself, so I probably should tell you what the movie's about. It's about giant ants that are created by the first nuclear test at Alamogordo 9 years later in 1954. They start going out looking for things to eat. And that's basically the plot of the film, but it's structured really interestingly in that it's structured as a police procedural almost at the start, and then it evolves into a much bigger thing and moves across part of the country to Los Angeles. But it's a really well-made film, and one of those iconic ones that people see when they're a kid and love for the rest of their lives. And with good reason, too. It's not one of those movies that deteriorates if you see it later on, having seen it as a kid. It's keeps its value and it keeps its preciousness. Not in a sarcastic sense, but a real preciousness that is one of the hallmarks of one of the good science fiction films from the 1950s. Of course, the film starts out with those iconic images of the spotter plane flying across the desert and a police patrol car finding a little girl just marching across the desert holding a doll. And she's in some kind of catatonic state or deep shock. And the cop, played by James Whitmore and his partner, pick her up, and then they find the parents' caravan, which has been ripped apart from outside. And then they go down to a local store and find it's been ripped apart from outside. And slowly it builds towards us finding out about these giant ants, which is a nice way to do it. I don't think anyone really went to the movie not knowing it was about giant ants, but you kind of respect it for taking us through the paces and not just slamming us with it right at the start. It's intelligent in that way. It follows things through logically as well. The whole plot follows logically there. Given the one proviso in that ants can't grow that big, their legs wouldn't hold them up, and because they breathe through spiracles in their size, they couldn't get enough oxygen to run a metabolism of their size. But you've got to let them have that. We'll let them have that this time around because it is such a good science fiction movie. And one of the things that more and more, the more science fiction films I see, the more this particular thing becomes important to me. And that is the filmmakers respecting the material and taking it seriously when it needs to be taken seriously. If you're doing a comedy, yeah, you can yuck it up. But when you're doing a drama or a slash horror film like this one kind of is, having a respect for what you're doing really does lift the game a lot. It's an attitude more than anything that costs money in a movie. But it does pay off fantastic dividends in that if everybody is taking it seriously and treating the whole lot with respect and not just as a way of cashing checks, then the film is lifted. And I really like that, and I really appreciate that. And you can detect it fairly easily when you are watching movies. It's easy to see the ones where they're doing that compared to the ones where people think they're slumming it by making this kind of a film. When in reality, this film is 60 years old this year, and it holds up bloody well as an entertainment. And there are a lot of films that don't. But this one does, and I really love it for that reason. Now, the supporting cast is pretty good. James Arness, just before he became Matt Dillon in Gunsmoke, which went on for way too long as a TV series. Of course, he played the monster in Thing from Another World as well. But James Whitmore always was a very stodgy and stolid actor. He's a bit like his brother, Peter Graves. He's never going to be a terrifically nuanced actor. He's tall. He knew where to stand and he knew his lines. But him supposedly being the kind of love interest for the scientist character, who was played by Joan Weldon, kind of, it doesn't really work well because they've got no chemistry. And as Joan Weldon said when she was interviewed years later, and this is a very telling thing, particularly about the director Gordon Douglas, who was a jobbing director that did a lot of things all the way up into the 1970s. But Joan Weldon, when she was interviewed, and I'm just filling time while I get the IMDb up to do this. Here we go. I don't think much of the movie then when I read the script. I just knew that my character was a scientist, and I was hoping that somewhere along the line there should be some romance or love interest. But Gordon Douglas didn't want to refer to any kind of romance whatsoever. It was totally devoid of any interplay with anybody. The ants were supposed to be the stars. And, you know, I can see that point there too, but because there isn't that love interest, particularly between any of the characters, even though they kind of try to slightly, very minutely set it up, that enables Joan Weldon's character, whose name should be checked, and her name is Pat Medford, who goes out to investigate the ants along with her father, played by Edmund Gwenn, Dr. Harold Medford. she's, because of that kind of lack of lovey-dovey stuff, she's seen as a serious person. She's a top scientist in entomology. And because of that, and because she stands up herself, she has to go down into an ant's nest, and the guys are saying, oh, you can't go down there, you're a woman. But she gives them a good reason, argument why she should, and she goes down there with them. But, of course, then you get the screamy bit when the ants attack, which is par for the course of that movie. But there's that little bit of her standing up for herself and her having been someone with a career and with knowledge that's useful to the Enterprise. And even though it's not perfectly feminist the way we have things now, I kind of respect that too, the fact that they did let her be more than just a screaming female there to be rescued. And, you know, kudos to them for that. Now, getting back to Gordon Douglas, the director, he did some interesting films, nothing really big, but some things that made a bit of money and a couple of interesting movies. He made one of the Flint movies, in like Flint in 1967, the spy movies with James Coburn. He did another movie, which is a small one, which I really like for no good reason apart from the fact that I really like it. And that's a movie called Sylvia with Carol Baker and George Maharis in it, which black and white film made in 1965, but it's kind of interesting character piece, and I kind of like it for that. He made Robin and the Seven Hoods, the Rat Pack movie, which also had Bing Crosby in it. He did the remake of Stagecoach in 1966, but we'll forgive him that. He made the two Tony Rome movies with Sinatra, Tony Rome and Lady in Cement, in 67 and 68. He did another movie, which if I could ever find a decent copy of it, I would really love to do on the podcast. It's a movie called Skullduggery, which is about finding a missing link in the New Guinea jungles, and it stars Burt Reynolds, Chips Rafferty, and Susan Clarke. But the copies I've seen of it around the place are notoriously bad. But the only other thing that he did that was really interesting was Slaughter's Big Ripoff, the sequel to Slaughter. Remember when I talked about Slaughter and Boxcar Bertha a number of podcasts ago? He did the sequel to that. So he's done everything from blaxploitation all the way back to short films in the 1930s. He did something like 20 or 30 short films before they ever let him have a feature film. So he definitely paid his dues. Started out as a child actor in the silent days, which, you know, shows a career. He's gone all the way from the silent film times all the way through to blaxploitation, which is a long career, not a particularly distinguished one, but, you know, he paid his dues and he did the job. But back to the ants. Now, I was thinking about the ants this morning while I was having breakfast. And one of the things that I kind of like is the fact that the giant ants don't look particularly good from our point of view. Now we've got CGI and all sorts of wonderful things where we can make photorealistic fake ants. But this movie, you know, it was all giant puppets and great big models and things like that, which didn't particularly move naturally, and they're almost slightly abstract versions of giant ants. But the guys and women who were involved, and of course women did a lot of the sewing and a lot of the scut work making these kind of models, they did the best they could with what they had. And in spite of the rawness and the crudeness of the giant ants, you got to go along with it. It's one of those things where, like the fact that they can't breathe through their ribs and giant ants' legs would collapse and all that kind of stuff. We'll give the movie makers the fact that the ants look crude, but the way people react to them is what's important. And James Whitmore is at the heart of that. When he picks up the little girl in the desert and takes her to the police car, all that kind of thing, the genuine concern that he shows for her as a person is consistent with that jobbing policeman. He's got a very working class mug, James Whitmore, or he did have up until 2009 when he died. And he puts things across really well in that. And again, when he rescues the two boys from the sewers of Los Angeles, where the ants have set up a nest towards the end of the film, that concern and that depth of character and the realism really does bring this movie somewhere more than it was, which is kind of cool. The other thing I like James Whitmore for, and I'm talking on about him for a little bit because what the fuck, why not? Loved him in Kiss Me, Kate, where he sang Brush Up Your Shakespeare with Keenan Wynn. Yeah, not the kind of actor you'd see as a song and dance man, but he puts it across really well, and he's having fun too. He was at stage actor as well as a movie actor. And stage was his preferred medium, and I'd seen him in a whole bunch of other things. He's very good in a Twilight Zone episode. If you can find the Twilight Zone episode with James Whitmore in it, his acting in that is mind-blowingly good. And his career went all the way up to, he did Shawshank Redemption. He was in Shawshank Redemption as the old guy. And he also did a movie that I reviewed in 1998 for a website, a movie called The Relic, which had Tom Sizemore and Penelope Ann Miller in it, another monster movie. But he's in there as well, playing an aged scientist. And it was a good nod to them and other monster movies to have James Whitmore in there. And again, he was a jobbing actor, and he really did, and he deliberately aimed his career at, because of, you know, he wasn't a particularly tall guy and he had a bit of a rough mug, he really embraced the character actor life and knew that his career would be going the distance. Because if you do your job really well, if you're a good actor and you embrace the fact that you're going to be a character actor, then things go good with you. One of the things he said about being a jobbing actor was, let's have a look here. I certainly wasn't the idol of millions. I just happened to get good parts, and so I wasn't worried, because I could see these character parts stretching into the, you know, dim, dark days of the future. So he really had a realistic grasp of who he was and what his career would be, and I kind of like that too. He's just one of those actors I've got a lot of respect for because of who he was and what he done. But there are a few other bits and pieces to watch out for in the movie that are really nice screenshots. Let's see. The water bag on the front grille of the cop car, an old canvas water bag. I used to see those around trucks here in Australia as well. The amount of canvas water bag on the grille of a truck in the desert, and tip a bit of water over it, and so the evaporation of that water in the canvas cools down the water in the water bag, so you've got cool water to drink. This was in the days before cars were air-conditioned. So I kind of that. I love the 1950s helicopters they have in the movie as well. They're always really cool. And you've got to like any giant monster movie where people use bazookas for whatever reason. Bazookas are always a good sign of it. Now, one of the other things that kind of takes you out of the movie, but I kind of like as well, is they use the Wilhelm scream a couple of times. In fact, James Whitmore gets a Wilhelm scream towards the end of the movie as well. If you don't want to know what a Wilhelm scream is, it's this. Which has appeared in more movies in the MGM line. It's really the go-to sound effect for anything in particular where you need a guy doing a high-pitched scream. And it hits about two or three times during this movie, which takes you out of the film a little bit, but it's also something that movie buffs kind of get off on. By the way, I misspoke before. It's actually a Warner Brothers film. It's not a Universal one, so it's not in the Universal science fiction movies set in the desert with giant monsters kind of genre. Interesting thing is that Warner Brothers was considered the working class, the working man's studio. They had people like Humphrey Bogart and all of those really interesting faces. Okay, here's some bits of trivia that I just found on IMDb, which are going to be interesting. Leonard Nimoy has a cameo in there as a soldier who reads a wire copy story about the pilot being held in a mental hospital in Texas. Fess Parker's in there, the guy who played Daniel Boone. Interesting thing was, Walt Disney screened the film. He wanted to look at James Arness to play Daniel Boone for the Daniel Boone TV series that he was going to do as a part of the Disneyland, Disney World kind of TV stuff. But ended up seeing Fess Parker playing a guy in a hospital and went with Fess Parker instead. So, yeah, and the other thing I was going to mention too is there's another strong female character in this movie, which is the female doctor who ends up looking after the traumatized child from the start of the film. And Doran plays that, not doctor, basically, which is kind of interesting too, because they could have taken a male doctor to do that and just had nurses around, but they chose not to. They chose to have the pediatric doctor be a woman, which I think is kind of good, and it's inclusive, which, again, goes back to Warner Brothers and that kind of working-class social justice background that studio has. If Universal had done it, they probably would have went with a male doctor, but they didn't. They went with a female doctor, and again, respect to them for doing that. But to finish it all up, we've got to get back to the theme. The theme of the movie is atomic annihilation. As with all of these 1950s giant bug movies, the ants were created at Alamogordo, and there's concerns about what the subsequent nuclear tests may create, and the threat of the ants travelling around, reproducing, and annihilating the human race is in that trailer at the start of the thing. So the stakes are pretty high in these kind of movies. It's the future of humanity is one of the big themes, and it's a very big theme, of course, because it is the 1950s, it's a Cold War. Russia and America both have nuclear weapons, and even if they didn't, the temptation to use such powerful munitions is there as well. So it's very much of its time because of that, and it reflects the concerns of its time, as indeed all good science fiction movies do. So I'm going to take another break now, and when I get back, we're going to talk about Mimic from 1997, another giant bug movie, but from a very different time and approached in a very different way.
Looking to the future, hoping for the best. One can take one's chances and put them to the test. With the aspirations and the adulations, one accepts with a hesitation the complimentary congratulations. All for one and one for all, the strength in numbers. What I've seen own it at the right time, own it when you're sure. Own him, make the right moves when you know that's what it's for. See it for the first time, a variation on a theme. See it for the last time and see what you mean, yeah. All for one, and one for all, the strength, the numbers, what I've seen. The future, hoping for the best. One can take one's chances and put them to the test. With the aspirations and the adulations, one accepts with a hesitation the complimentary congratulations. All for one and one for all, the strength, the numbers, what I've seen. Owner makes me wonder. Owner makes me wonder, baby. Owner makes me wonder. Owner makes me wonder, baby. Owner makes me wonder. Owner makes me wonder, baby. 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 Owner makes me wonder, baby.
That was Bachelors from Prague with the Irvin Rockman Affair. Bachelors from Prague were a band in the 90s, 80s and 90s in Melbourne here. Saw them live a couple of times, and very cool jazz lead singer Henry Mars went on to create the Black Cat Cafe in Fitzroy, one of the cool venues around town. So that I've been ripping a lot of vinyl, and that came up, and I thought, geez, I've got to listen to more of my Bachelors from Prague. But I've got stacks and stacks of vinyl around here that I'm ripping in the man cave, and occasionally little gems like that do pop up. So, on with Mimic, Guillermo del Toro's 1997 bug movie.
Strickler's disease came to New York like a thief in the night. It was deadly, threatening to steal an entire generation of our children from before our eyes.
Since it has proven to be virtually immune to chemical control, we had to find a new avenue of attack. We recombined DNA to create a biological counteragent. We call it the Judas Breed.
3 years ago, a team of brilliant scientists found a way to stop a deadly disease. Now, the cure they created has taken on a life of its own.
So you think your little Frankenstein's got the better of you?
There's some weird shit here. Lots of it.
They all died in the lab.
But you let them out. Evolution is a way of keeping things alive.
Sometimes an insect will evolve to mimic its predator. A fly can look like a spider. A caterpillar can look like a snake. They are breeding.
Whatever it becomes, it destroys.
Peter, these are lungs.
Yesterday, it became human.
If that thing has been around, I know nobody's ever seen it.
I think we have.
You see the size of that thing?
We changed its DNA.
Survive this.
Mira Sorvino, Jeremy Northam, Josh Brolin, Charles Dutton, Giancarlo Giannini, F. Murray Abraham. Mimic.
That's not a bad trailer. It's got that kind of in a whirl voiceover to it, and then it covers the waterfront pretty well. Even tells you who's in the movie, so I don't have to. I like this movie. I first saw it when it came out in 97. I was seeing a few things in it. As I mentioned with James Whitmore a bit earlier, I saw The Relic, which is another good monster movie from the time, but this one came out just after Kronos, the Spanish language movie that Guillermo del Toro did, which I recommend as well. I really should do that on a future podcast because it's a really interesting variation on vampirism, which is kind of cool, and which del Toro's coming back to with his new TV series, The Strain. So there is that. Now, del Toro's an intelligent director, and also he knows his genres really well. And this one does do things quite nicely too. Again, a little bit like them, it comes at things from an approach of being a somewhat different movie. As they mention in the trailer, Strickler's disease, which has polio-like effects from the way it's presented in the film, has ravaged, I'm going to be very careful because that'd be a very different kind of movie, ravaged a whole generation of New York City kids, and it's carried by cockroaches. Cockroaches being ubiquitous in New York, this presented something of a problem. So the type of bug was genetically engineered called the Judas strain, and this was genetically engineered by, amongst other people, Mira Sorvino's character, Dr. Susan Tyler. Now, she meets, at the time of the Strickler's disease, she meets Dr. Peter Mann, a doctor played by Jeremy Northam, and they become married, and they're trying to have a child. So, 3 years later, people start disappearing on the streets of New York. The Judas strain was only supposed to last for a few months. It was one generation sterile insect that created an enzyme that killed cockroaches, therefore getting rid of Strickler's disease. And everybody was commended for it, and they went away. But things went wrong, as they tend to do. Now, again, like Them is a movie about the perils of nuclear warfare and nuclear weapons. This one is about the perils of genetic engineering and the threat of disease as well. So what they slowly discover, and this is given away in the trailers, is that the Judas bug has evolved and grown larger over thousands and thousands of generations under the streets of New York to become human-sized and, as the title of the movie suggests, mimicking human form. They look like men, tall men in overcoats when they're kind of curled around themselves, and part of the carapace forms something that looks not unlike a human face. Now, the movie, it's got an interesting origin to it. It's based on a short story by Donald A. Walheim, one of the great early science fiction writers and editors. He edited the first mass-marketed science fiction anthology back in 1943. So he really is one of the progenitors of the genre as we know it. He started out as a science fiction fan. He was one of the Futurians, the first science fiction fan group, back in the 1930s. And then in 1943, The Pocketbook of Science Fiction came out, where he had a whole bunch of short stories brought together, Robert Heinlein, Theodore Sturgeon, Ambrose Bierce, H.G. Wells, and went on to become an editor and boost the careers of a number of people, including Philip K. Dick. Walheim was the guy who edited the Ace Doubles. They were paperbacks made very cheaply, and on one side of the paperback you had one story, and you flipped it over, on the other side there was another whole other book on the back of it. And Walheim was a person who invented and produced those, and Ace Doubles are now going for immense amounts of money if you look around the place, because they were just so ubiquitous in the 50s and 60s that people have a fondness for them, and a lot of stories that you can't find elsewhere were produced in Ace Doubles. That's interesting. William S. Burroughs' first book, Junkie, was published as an Ace Double as well. So Walheim's got a long history. I've read the short story. It is available, not for download, but available to view online. And the story is basically just about a health inspector who finds a bug that's evolved to the size of a human being in a boarding house. It's a very short story. It's only got one act, really. And if you go looking for it, you'll find it online, and you can view it for yourself. And the thing that they really take for the movie from the short story is that concept of an insect that evolves to look like a human being, in order to hide amongst its only real predators being us. Now, Mira Sorvino's in this one. Actually, by sheer coincidence, she's the daughter of the actor Paul Sorvino. I don't suppose that's a coincidence, but by coincidence, I saw a movie with Paul Sorvino in it last night called The Day of the Dolphin, which I'll plan to use for a future Paleo Cinema podcast, perhaps. But, yeah, so she comes from an acting family. And she did get the Best Supporting Actress Oscar for Mighty Aphrodite back in the mid-1990s. And there was a big discussion on whether she should have won and whether someone read out the wrong name and all that kind of thing. But she hasn't done terribly large amounts of stuff since then. I don't know whether it's because of that controversy about the Oscar, or whether she's just chosen not to, or whether she's got other kind of directions in her life these days, but she does a pretty good job of it. I don't think she's particularly the go-to actress you think of when you're thinking scientists, but she puts across the techno-babble and the science stuff pretty well. With her is Jeremy Northam, an English actor playing American in this one, who I've talked about in a previous Martian Drive-In podcast when I was talking about Cypher with Grant and Sonia back in the early days of this podcast. Good actor. He's doing some interesting stuff, and he's doing character roles these days. in a lot of English television and other things, but I kind of like him as an actor. I don't think he's the leading man type particularly, but he does have a certain honesty about the way he approaches things that makes it work. Josh Brolin's in this. It's an earlier role for Josh Brolin, who we now know from any number of other things, including No Country for Old Men. And he kind of grew into that craggy face he's got, and you can just see the starts of it in this one. He plays the assistant to Jeremy Northam's character while they're investigating all the mysterious goings-on under the streets of New York. Charles S. Dutton's in there as a transit policeman, and he does a really nice job of it too. Again, he's one of those working-class actors. He's a black actor, a working-class actor who's got an honest working-class face and can play those kind of characters. He plays Leonard, the transit cop, and has some interesting scenes as they investigate the mimic bugs underneath the streets of New York. And really, in some ways, he steals the movie away from everybody else. We've also got Giancarlo Giannini, the Italian actor who is famous for things like Seven Beauties back in the day. He plays Manny, whose son, Chewy, played by a boy called Alexander Goodwin, is probably autistic and mimics sounds playing the spoon. So he mimicked the weird sounds that the mimics use. He mimicked the mimics. And also he's got a kind of Rain Man obsession with shoes because Manny's a shoe shine person on the subways. And so Chewy has an obsession with shoes, and he is a bit confused because the mimics have weird shoes. You got a little bit coming in with F. Murray Abrahams, who I've got a bone to pick with in this movie. He's talking about a philosopher, and he calls him Camus, but it's actually Camus. So he mispronounced the name of a philosopher while giving a lecture at a university. So, fuck you guys. This is something that Harlan Ellison brought up in an essay once, how Camus' name always gets mispronounced by people in scripts for TV and movies. So there is that one as well. But F. Murray Abraham, I liked since I first saw him in a thing called The Big Fix with Richard Dreyfuss, where Richard Dreyfuss plays an ex-hippie private eye. Not a bad little movie itself. I kind of got a fondness for that one as well. But in here is very much a minor role. Now, to get to the movie itself, basically what happens is people are getting grabbed by these bugs off the streets of New York, and Susan Tyler and the Jeremy Northam character go to investigate. Meanwhile, Chewie's being kidnapped by the bugs, who don't kill him, possibly because being autistic, he's not scared of them, and so it doesn't let out any fear pheromones. It's not stated in the movie, but that's my reading of it anyway. And so both Manny, Leonard, who's a transit cop, Josh Brolin's character, and the couple go down into the tunnels beneath the streets of New York to investigate what's going on and to ultimately destroy the bugs. As a giant bug movie, this is very, very different from them. For a start, it's set in an urban setting rather than out in the desert, which gives it some points. And it was filmed in Toronto, faking New York. And, of course, New Yorkers would know immediately that it wasn't New York. In fact, I know immediately it wasn't New York, but it kind of works well. And a lot of the underground scenes and other things have a slight sickly green tint to them, which is a stylistic choice that Del Toro made there. There's a kind of bug guts glow to the light as they descend into the tunnels. And it's raining, it's damp. You get a sense of kind of cold and damp and clamminess underneath these tunnels, in these tunnels underneath New York, which kind of works well. We've got a lot of Del Toro's obsessions in this one. Bugs and guts, and one of the brave things he does is he actually kills a couple of kids. Now, there's a kind of taboo in particularly US cinema on killing children, even in horror films. But Del Toro goes ahead and does it. He's got no compunction about it because it works toward building the tension when Chewie gets captured by the bugs. You know these bugs aren't going to let him go because he's a kid, because a couple of kids have already been killed by them. So you ramp up the tension in with that as well. The deaths of a couple of different characters that precede the peril that the main characters are in ramp up that tension, because you know that people can be killed by these things and that they're not just kind of hiding from people. They're actually using people as one of their food sources, which is kind of icky and gooey and works really well. The movie basically is more atmospheric than tense, I think. But I kind of like it because, A, it's gone back to a source material way back from the genre I love, science fiction. And B, it's different from the stuff that was going on at the time. It really does not just have a standard bug invasion, but looks at how would a large bug camouflage itself in an urban setting by looking more or less like a human being. Now, the effects work, of course, 40-odd years later, are far in advance of the effects we had in something like them. But there's still live physical effects at this stage. They haven't quite gone to CGI yet. The live physical effects, Rob Bottin, amongst others, did work on the makeup effects for this one. And there's a lot of puppetry and things like that. But the bugs do come across extremely well. I haven't gone into the special effects side of things for this movie particularly to see exactly how they were done, but however they were done, I think it's a combination of live action and puppetry from what I can see. I can't see really any CG shots in there, though I could be wrong and I'm willing to be corrected on. But I think they're really effective, and one of the nice things that you get from a live effect as opposed to a CG effect is the physics are naturally perfect. You don't have to kind of calculate the physics of something if you're doing it as a live effect the way you do if you're doing it as a special effect. And the eye and the mind can perceive that difference. For instance, when Del Toro did Pacific Rim last year, one of the issues he was trying to get the physics of the giant robots wading through water right. And then when they crunched the physics exactly right with the fluid dynamics on the water and all the rest of it and the mass of the giant robots, they found out that the splashes made by the giant robots would go way over their heads and you wouldn't see the robots. So they had to actually fake the physics of the giant robots to make them look right for a movie context. Whereas with physical effects, you don't have to have those tweaks and twitches. You just do the physical effects and people get the idea of things slamming against things without millions of teraflops of data of data calculations being done. So there is that argument for keeping, even with CG, a certain amount of physical effects rather than CG effects, because our minds are still at that stage and the technology is still at that stage where we can tell the difference with our minds. And there's a kind of heightened realism to really doing things rather than doing them as CGI. I mean, I'm in big in favour of CGI. There are things that CGI can do that we can't with physical effects. I think a combination of the two is probably the best way to go about this stuff.
Sometimes an insect will evolve to mimic its predator. A fly can look like a spider. A caterpillar can look like a snake. The Judas evolved to mimic its predator. Us.
Nobody up there knows about this.
Nobody would. Not until it's too late. These things can imitate us, they can infiltrate us, and breed a legion before anyone would even notice.
How could you do this? How could you do this? You take something, you make it like a man. A man who's not a man.
Manny!
He's a thing.
Manny!
Hey, you tell him, Manny. You tell her, because she don't give a goddamn.
Hey.
Your kids go
to
my legs.
Shut up,
will you? And they're both
shut
talking
the
about insects
up.
With lungs.
Shut
up! And so I just said there were two sequels to this one, which I haven't seen yet. I've picked up copies of them. and That cough was deliberate, by the way. And I'll probably watch them a little bit later, but given that the budgets were increasingly small, I'm not too optimistic about the quality of the films. But, you know, you do these things when you, the way I did with Scanners, I watched Scanners 2 and parts of Scanners 3, just to see how things went from there. But there's not too much else to say about Mick. Again, Del Toro is an interesting director. I really love the Hellboy movies because they're a lot of fun and they're based on comics and they just use effects in a very interesting way. And it's got Ron Perlman and John Hurt in it, so that's never a downside anyway. But that's about it for Mimic. It's worth revisiting. There is a director's cut, and I recommend that you get that. The director's cut is about 6 minutes longer. And Del Toro, at the time they were making this, had lots of arguments with Harvey Weinstein about how it should go. But eventually Weinstein let him do a director's cut. The extra bits are mostly for the clarification of plot points. They're not to throw a whole bunch of extra special effects and shit like that in there. They actually do strengthen the movie, and they don't add too much time to it. So I recommend, if at all possible, to get that one. I've got a DVD copy, which isn't the director's cut. And I had to go and find an AVI, the director's cut, for comparison. And it's a wise director's cut. There are some that are just there to boost the ego of the director, but I don't think that's the case with this one. I really think it is an honest cut of the film to add those extra 6 minutes of character development and explanation in there. But anyway, I'm going to take another break now, and when I get back, there is a shit ton of feedback.
What a day this has been. What a rare mood I'm in. Why, it's almost like being in love. There's a smile on my face for the whole human race. Why, it's almost like being in love. All the music of life seems to be like a bell that is ringing for me. And from the way that I feel when that bell starts to peal, I would swear I was falling, swear I was falling. Why, it's almost like being in love. Of life seems to be like a bell that is ringing for me. And from the way that I feel when that bell starts to peal, I would swear I was falling, swear I was falling. Why, it's almost like being in love.
That was Nat King Cole with Almost Like Being in Love, which featured on the soundtrack to Groundhog Day. The song originally came from Brigadoon, but it ain't in this case. And that's a good upbeat version of it to kind of make it into something that it wasn't in the original incarnation. Now, onto the feedback. I got a message on the Martian Drive-In podcast website from Jeff Sanza telling me that I hadn't put up the link to the direct download on the website itself. And we had a little bit of a conversation about that. Yeah, I slipped up on that one, but if you really want to get from the source the download files for Martian Drive-In podcast, you can go to martiandrivein.podbean.com and all of the podcasts are there directly from the hosting company. Or you can go to marsdrivein.blogspot.com if you want, and I'll make sure that I do it next time. Getting a bit slack with this stuff, and I've really got to pick up my game a little bit. But before I do any more feedback than that, I do have something here. I've put it out on social media, but I'm going to put it out on the podcast as well, and I'll do it on Paleo Cinema as well. I've got a deal going with you, my listenership. The first person to put up a Paleo Cinema Wikipedia page gets to pick two movies that I will do in Paleo Cinema Podcast. They've still got to be more than 20 years old, but you get to pick the two movies if you put up a Wikipedia page for the podcast. Now, I can't do it because you can't put up a Wikipedia page for something you're directly involved in or something you are and you own. There's some kind of rule there that says that I can't do it. But if somebody else wants to, and they can then be edited by anybody, so you can put outrageous things there saying that I was once caught in a toilet with Tom Selleck or whatever you want to put up there. But once the website's up, you can do that. So that's the deal. First person who can provide me with proof that they put up a Paleo Cinema Podcast Wikipedia page gets to pick two movies for the podcast. This is my little bribe to get somebody who's willing to do so to put it up. If you want information to put on the Wikipedia page, I'm more than happy to provide the information. But I can't do it directly for myself. So you can email me at the usual places if you want to get any information to put up there. But once you've created and had approved the Wikipedia page for Paleo Cinema Podcast, you get to pick the two movies, and I will do it as soon as I can after that. This is the only provisions are more than 20 years old, and I've got to be able to find copies of the movies. So I'm putting that out there for everybody around the place. Once the website is up, if you're a Wikipedia editor, you can add to it. But I can't create the page myself. So moving along, did get a bit of feedback. Let me just go into the email here. I got one from Roman Scott saying, "Hi, Terry. Your two cinema podcasts are among my favorites. It's impressive how you're able to carry the show by yourself. Your life experiences and critical insights, not to mention humor, being enough to make the soliloquy interesting. You often get me to revisit or see films for the first time. Such was the case with Scanners, a film I remember hearing about in younger years but never saw until now. The film has a touch of dread associated with it, as I recall a high school friend bragging about having seen a monstrosity involving exploding heads. Later, I came to know the actor Stephen Lack during my New York years in the 90s. At the time, he had moved on from acting, pursuing a career as a painter. It's weird to see a guy you know, not as an actor, appearing as a main character in a film. I enjoyed your discussion about Patrick McGowan, an actor important to me in my younger days via The Prisoner. I had no idea of his demons, and now knowing this will flavour the way I see his performances, enhancing my appreciation. Living in Norway, your account of everyday life in the other hemisphere allows me to bask vicariously in a warmer place. I'll put on my earmuffs and dream away as I get a workout shoveling snow. Big distances on the globe shrink through the medium of podcasting. Distances recede further as you discuss these artifacts on film, taking us on a journey to a shared space. Best, Roman Scott." Thanks, Roman, and I hope you're staying warm there in Norway. Not a place I would particularly live because I tend to be a more a warm climate kind of person, and even though it does for me get cold here in Melbourne in winter, it's nowhere near what you guys get. But yeah, Stephen Lack, interesting actor, really striking look, and I had heard that he moved on and become a painter as well. I hope he was successful, and I hope it made him happy. I believe he has stepped on a rainbow since then, but his look really makes it work well. And McGowan, knowing more about actors sometimes can colour the way that you view things. For instance, George C. Scott, guy beat up women when he got drunk. So that's kind of had a diminishing effect on my appreciation of his work because of that. It's not something that I like. It's something that I have had knowledge of from a very early age and have seen the effects of from a very early age. So I'm very negative about that for more than just politically correct reasons. And George C. Scott's one of those actors that I find difficult to watch because of those aspects of his personal life. But yeah, sharing things across the planet. Every now and then I dip into the geostats, they're called, at Podbean for who's listening to the podcast. And we're getting people from all sorts of interesting places. I'm getting them from all across the Caribbean. We're getting a lot more in Australia now, which is nice because I live here. We're getting a lot of people from North America. You can hardly see any of the map now from the little teardrop-shaped markers there. and increasingly across Europe as well. So it's really heartening that people are listening. And yeah, sharing knowledge of movies and reminding people of films and hipping them to new films that they weren't aware of is what I do. I was having a chat with Liz Travascus pretty much the same way when we're talking about why I'm doing this and how I'm doing the movie stuff for the radio. And that's what it's about. It's about sharing knowledge. And knowledge is useless unless it's shared, unless it's put to some use. And even if it is just passing it on to somebody else, even if I'd never use it for anything practical in my life, passing it on and interacting with other people and getting their knowledge as well and nurturing myself through that is just such an important part of what happens here. And again, it is such a new medium, and it is something that the 21st century is giving us in a meaningful way. And even though people do say that social media keeps people apart, I found things to be the contrary to that. So thank you very much for that one, Roman, and keep listening, please. And if you want to offer feedback, I'm always happy to accept it. Now, moving right along, I has a voicemail.
Hi, Terry. It's Tim again from upstate New York and Facebook. I am driving back home again, as I was when I called you the last time, making these calls partly because it gives me something to do as I drive back home, and I promised you I'd do them. And at least unlike the last time I thought I would call, I don't have a rather terrified kitten in the seat next to me. Long story, I'll tell you about it on Facebook. Anyway, couple of things about the recent Martian Drive-In podcast. As I say, I've got a bunch of notes that I put together on the note-taking app on my iPhone, and I wanted to finally get them off my chest and off my iPhone and on the air for you, or on the podcast for you, as the case may be. The Doctor Who thing that you mentioned, I think it was Martian Drive-In podcast number 22, where you mentioned that you played a selection from one of the Doctor Who versus the Daleks, I think. I wanted to point out that technically Peter Cushing is not a canonical doctor. He is a human named Doctor who has a time machine that happens to be the TARDIS. But he is not, in fact, the Doctor, a Gallifreyan Time Lord who regenerates into different characters. That's why you never see Peter Cushing show up as the Doctor in any of the New Who thing. But I thought I'd just let you know that. That song Man of Steel you played was, I gotta admit, I love it. I really appreciate you playing all these really obscure and sometimes downright filthy songs that we couldn't hear anyplace else. There are times your show is kind of like Dr. Demento with a hard R rating, and that's what one of the things we love about you, Terry. Anyway, I was really interested to hear you talking in podcast number, was it 23? Yes, I think it was 23. About Person of Interest, which is also one of Tammy's and I's favorite shows. And you have a really interesting take on it, actually. I had not considered, prior to you mentioning it, that Person of Interest could be seen as a science fiction show about the first benevolent, sentient, artificial intelligence. I mean, there's always been those elements there, but the show always basically treats it as, oh yeah, this is just, this is something we theoretically think we can already do, and it's a mystery thriller, spy adventure, kind of like The Equalizer or Batman or something, and it gives it a whole new perspective looking at it as a science fiction show, I think, and makes you wonder if the program isn't going to head more into that direction now that the machine is out on its own. And Root is basically it's basically her Jane the Baptist, keeping in mind that Root always sees the machine as the sacred feminine. Also, I couldn't agree with you more, sadly, about Person of Interest. Not Person of Interest, Marvel Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. It was a show I really hoped would be fantastic. I was really looking forward to it. It was like the show everybody wanted to see, including me. Because it was like, oh great, a spy thriller involving the secret agency S.H.I.E.L.D. And, you know, even if they don't use superheroes, we'll get the ins and the outs and all this. Because I used to be a huge Nick Fury Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. fan as a kid, back when it was a comic, monthly comic book. And I look at it now and it's just like, it's blah. I mean, it's really kind of blah. It's not even remotely interesting. I feel like what's probably happening is that Marvel has way too much power in this case, because it doesn't even look like anything anybody who's named Whedon, or Tasharon Whedon, as the case may be. I assume Tasharon is how Marissa, she pronounces her last name, has written before. It feels like, honestly, it feels like it's being written by the people who write Castle, which is that ABC television show here in the U.S., ABC TV U.S., not ABC TV Australia. The one starring Nathan Fillion from Firefly and Dr. Horrible, and Stana Kotick, who was in the Spirit movie, and she was also in the last season of Heroes as an Israeli superhero, and she's been on 24 as a Russian a few times. They're both really engaging actors stuck in a rotten show. Marvel Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. has the rotten writing of Castle, but doesn't have the engaging actors to make up for it. And it's not that Clark Gregg isn't an engaging actor or can't be in another context, but he needs interesting, colorful people to bounce off of, because he's kind of the wry, sarcastic, straight man. And nobody on that show is a colorful character to bounce off him. And it really kind of hurts him, and I think it hurts the show a great deal. I think in 23 you also reviewed Death Race 2000, which is one of my favorite movies. It was hilarious when it first came out. I remember seeing, I was living in Southern California at that time, and seeing them use some of the futuristic architecture of Southern California, like the Fleur Building, which was supposedly where the race starts. And it seems to me that this was the first car chase movie that Roger Corman had actually... I mean, he had racing movies when he was younger, and motorcycle movies in the 60s, but this was the first time he realized that, hey, there's a market out there of people wanting to watch car chase and car crash movies, and I can make money this way, because it kind of led to things like Eat My Dust. It kind of led to... things like he did an early version of Gumball Rally, which was this one of those, we're going to drive across country as fast as we can and the hell with 55-mile-an-hour speed limit, which was a big thing in the United States in the 70s. To save fuel, our national highways were slowed down to 55 miles an hour, and nobody liked it. So... I think it wasn't for the success of Death Race 2000, Corman wouldn't have tried doing car chase movies with a less science fictional setting. So in a sense, you could say indirectly, because Ron Howard was the star of Eat My Dust and the star and did his directorial debut in Grand Theft Auto, both for Roger Corman, you could say that Death Race 2000 led to Ron Howard's directorial career. And I just wanted to share that thought with you. And you're right, that Paul Bartel is a really interesting director, and it's a pity that he didn't do more. I mean, he did this, he did Private Parts, which is a really kinky, interesting, freaky movie that I kind of like, actually. He also did Eating Raoul, which is a rather clever sick joke. It sort of took off all of those, how can we make all these slasher movies more clever and witty rather than just some guy in a, some kind of a mask going around killing people. But I really think Edie Raoul probably did the best job of them all, even though it was also the least explicit of all of them. It was mostly basically a dark humored comedy. So anyway, and now we get to Martian Drive-In podcast number 25, which I don't have notes on, but which I recently listened to you talking about and really enjoyed hearing your take on two of my favorite movies. I think Scanners is probably Cronenberg's most accessible film, even more so than The Fly, which was also pretty accessible, or The Dead Zone, which doesn't exactly feel like a David Cronenberg movie. It feels like David Cronenberg behaving himself so that he can get more work. Scanners, I had not actually considered the possibility that Stephen Lack's lacking performance might have been partly a deliberate choice, that in fact, it wasn't that Cronenberg didn't realize that he wasn't a very good actor, but that Cronenberg was saying, you know, don't worry about it. This actually sort of plays into your character's uncomfortable in his own skin affect. And now that I think about it, that kind of works in ways that I had not even considered before, and I kind of like it, actually. Unfortunately, I don't even think Scanners is legally available or is readily available in the U.S. on DVD anymore, and the only Blu-ray I've seen of it was Out of Britain, which I ordered with my own Newton Mass money, and should be with me at home once I get there. And I'm going to try to watch it on my computer and see if there are any special features with it, because this is a movie I think that really deserves a Criterion edition or a Blue Underground, which is sort of a, I've talked about Lustig Blue Underground. It tries to give the Criterion treatment to 70s drive-in movies, and I think it does generally a really good job. But Scanners was the kind of movie that had, where you think that there's a lot of B-movie dropped threads and things that got mentioned that will never be picked up again, only to realize that, no, Cronenberg's very deliberately putting all this together to build up this rather elaborate universe. And it's really great, and it was strong enough to justify a number of sequels, none of which were anywhere near as good. You were right there. I never actually saw Scanner Cop, so I can't say offhand, but the fact of the matter is it, the world was large enough that people could think about making other movies in it, and I think that's pretty impressive. And, yes, I'm glad to hear that you also saw Flesh Gordon when it first came out. I think I may be one of the handful of people who saw it in a theater in its original X-rated version with all the stuff in, including in the version I saw in theaters the first several times. Yes, you actually saw Flesh and Prince Precious having oral sex. When you saw the later versions that played drive-ins in the more mainstream theaters, you would just see this quick pan away from Flesh and Prince Precious. You wouldn't even see what was going on. And you see that guy playing grab ass with Dr. Jerkoff. But you're absolutely right that it was kind of odd and rather welcome that, yes, they are actually admitting that, hey, male gay sex happens too. And Prince Precious is a likable, sympathetic, openly gay hero. Even if he is somewhat stereotyped, but then it's a 70s comedy. It's The monster of porn, the god of porno, has got to be my favorite part of the movie. Sammy's favorite part of the movie, too. She was kind of watching it with me, sort of going, yeah, I can kind of see why you like it, but nah, it's not really that good. Nah, not quite for me. Yeah. And then the monster comes up, and he's like, oh, boy. And she's like, ooh, he's cool. She loved the whole bit with the monster. And it's true, they had a lot of people from the science fiction and fantastic film community of the late 60s and early 70s working on that film. In some ways, I think it probably was one of the best special effects films to happen between 2001 or, well, okay, let's be fair, Silent Running is also a great effects film. But it was kind of, few people saw it. And Star Wars. I mean, Flesh Gordon was still actually playing in parts of Southern California when Star Wars came out. And it was kind of an interesting contrast to realize, here are your two science fiction extravaganzas. And then to realize that they actually kind of had a fair bit in common, too. Anyway, wanted to give you a call for a Martian Drive-In podcast. We'll hopefully see you in Australia in April with you and Sally. And I'm going to ring off now. So you guys, hope you have a great January. Enjoy.
Yeah, hi, Tim. Thanks for all of that. Yeah, as far as Peter Cushing not being canon Doctor Who, I don't care. He's Doctor Who as far as I'm concerned. Do it as an alternate universe thing. I don't care. I think that getting too precious about this sort of stuff veers us into kind of religious orthodoxy in a way. And I'm not into that sort of thing at all. I mean, you know, kick out all the walls as far as I'm concerned. So, yeah. I'm glad you like the songs because I'm trying to throw together a bit of audio now and then and throw some weird and wonderful stuff that I have around the man cave into the mix and getting it out there. Bachelors from Prague in this episode, for instance, is one of those examples. So I'm glad that it's going over well. Person of interest. Yep, I like it increasingly as the science fiction aspects do come into the fore with it. And I like the fact that the machine sees Root as, every time it has her on the screen, it says analog interface. So basically, Root is the analog interface for the sentient, benign AI behind the series, which is kind of cool. And they're all veering to the Edward Snowden kind of area and WikiLeaks, and they've always been had their finger on the pulse of that kind of thing, but taking it to that nth degree, which is really an interesting approach. But yeah, as far as highways going at 55 miles an hour, ours tend to be between 80 and 110k in Victoria, though my friends in the Northern Territory, after about an 8-year gap, have opened up the road north of Alice Springs, 200 kilometres of road, with no speed limits. So basically, that opened up this weekend. So what's happened is everybody with a high-performance car, including a couple who have got a Aston Martin Vanquish, have headed up to Alice Springs and are tearing up and down the highway 200 kilometres long because it's the only highway in Australia at this stage which has no speed limit at all. The Northern Territory government is looking at doing more than that. But if they were to do it between, say, Alice Springs and Darwin at the moment, it'd be problematic because the Adelaide River's in flood, as are a number of other rivers. And as soon as you hit a crocodile-infested flooded river, you are not going to be going at 200 or 300 kilometres an hour in your high-performance muscle car. You're going to be aeroplaning and then tumbling. So that's going on there, and it's just another... people are saying that people are going to die on it, and it's going to be an immense disaster, but I've been along some of those roads as far south as the Adelaide River, and they're dead flat two-lane blacktop with nothing for hundreds of kilometres. So, occasionally people are going to collect a camel or a kangaroo or something else along those lines, but it's social Darwinism. You've got to let that kind of thing happen. But I'm glad you're enjoying the show, Tim. And yes, we are going to catch up in April. So we'll have to kind of, my people will talk to your people and we'll work that out so that you and me and Tammy and Sally can hook up while you're in Melbourne. Not hook up, but, you know, meet up. Hook up is something else entirely, I believe. But, thanks for that. Anyway, that's about it for the feedback. It is now approaching 40 degrees centigrade outside, and I can see if I stretch my neck this way that my tomato plants are starting to suffer for it, so I've got to go out and do something to help them with it. So anyway, everyone take care of yourselves. I'll be back in 2 weeks with another Martian Drive-In podcast. I'll be back in a week with another Paleo Cinema podcast. So enjoy your movies in the meantime. Stay warm if you need to. Stay cool if you need to. If you're right there in the middle, as my friends in Darwin are, stay dry because they're going through an enormous wet season at the moment. The tides up at Nightcliff Beach yesterday were 8 meters tall. And so all the people, all the locals gathered around to watch the tide wash over the car park and splash against some cars and things like that. So that's how they entertain themselves. The weather is getting weird, but if we all band together and we stop people from telling us it's not happening, marvelous things are going to happen. So look after yourselves and I'll be back really, really soon. See ya.